Hello, this is Claudia, and for the next hour I'll be reading from the September 24th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Your countries are going to hell, Trump airs his grievances at the UN. In a meandering address, President Trump rebuked global institutions and complained about immigration, environmentalists, windmills, and more. He accused environmentalists of wanting to kill all the cows. He personally insulted the Muslim mayor of London. He bashed allies and foes across the globe. He questioned whether the United Nations should even exist. What is the purpose of the United Nations? President Trump asked a gathering of the UN General Assembly on Tuesday in a meandering 56-minute speech that extended nearly four times as long as his allotted time limit. I'm really good at this stuff, Mr. Trump said. Your countries are going to hell. In his remarks, Mr. Trump lectured the United Nations and other countries about how they were failing and aired a list of grievances. Those included, but were not limited to, a malfunctioning escalator at the UN, his not winning a renovation contract at the United Nations during his time as a real estate developer, windmills, other countries' immigration policies, which he claimed were leading them to ruin, and the way Brazil is being run. Soon after his speech, Mr. Trump made news in another forum. In a social media post, he made a stunning pivot on Ukraine, saying the country with the support of Europe was in a position to fight and win all of Ukraine back in its original form. His declaration, a welcome development to European allies, was made shortly after a meeting in New York with President Vladimir Zelensky of Ukraine. But what appeared to be a major foreign policy shift in the afternoon came only after a lengthy morning lecture by the American president. The White House has billed Mr. Trump's address to the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly as a chance for the president to lay out his vision for how America should wield its power abroad. But Mr. Trump's day did not start well. An escalator he was riding on broke as he entered the building, and his teleprompter malfunctioned early in his speech. The White House accused UN staff of potentially attempting to sabotage him. While he appeared to be reading from prepared remarks, he often broke into ad libs. There was some policy discussed. He announced a new effort to enforce the Biological Weapons Convention that would use AI verification, and said he wanted a cessation of the development of nuclear weapons. Mr. Trump also issued a new warning that the U.S. military would continue to play the role of judge, jury, and executioner in killing suspected drug smugglers operating in international waters. We will blow you out of existence, he warned anyone moving drugs out of Venezuela. But he spent nearly a quarter of his speaking time attacking efforts to address climate change. Mr. Trump undermined the scientific consensus on climate change, saying it was made by stupid people. He celebrated the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord and clean, beautiful coal. He talked about American energy exports and added that the United States has been taken advantage by much of the world, but not anymore. And Mr. Trump called climate change the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world and claimed environmentalists are out to eliminate America's cows. No more cows. We don't want cows anymore. I guess they want to kill all the cows, Mr. Trump said. He briefly turned to the topic of religion, falsely claiming that Muslim leaders in the West are planning to institute Sharia law while proclaiming Christianity to be the most persecuted religion on the planet. According to the White House, Mr. Trump had always planned to target globalist institutions in his speech. Since taking office, he has made drastic changes to America's approach to foreign policy. He has largely eschewed the use of non-military soft power, severely cutting foreign aid and dismantling the U.S. Agency for International Development. He has declined to pay for more aid to help Ukraine fight off Russia's invasion or try to put any limits on Israel's broadened military campaign in Gaza. And he has told strongman leaders of other countries that the United States would no longer sit in judgment of them. Several close U.S. allies issued what amounted to a reprimand this week of his go-it-alone vision, joining most of the U.N. body in recognizing Palestine as a state and risking the ire of the president, who has adamantly opposed such a move. The president, for his part, has made it clear he wants little to do with much of the UN mandate. He has withdrawn the United States from the UN's Human Rights Council and ordered a review of America's role in the organization. The Trump administration clawed back $1 billion in funding for the UN and informed Congress of its intent to cut another $1 billion, adding to a funding shortfall at the United Nations. But at the same time, Mr. Trump has inserted America into peace negotiations in conflicts across the globe, including the war in Gaza. The president has also shown a willingness to use a quick show of force, as he did when he ordered airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities. Mr. Trump, who is in open pursuit of a Nobel Peace Prize, trumpeted his role in bringing about several peace agreements or ceasefires during his speech, including a deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan and Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Then he argued he was doing as a side job what the UN should. Sadly, in all cases, the United Nations did not even try to help in any of them, he said, adding that all I got from the United Nations was an escalator on the way up that stopped right in the middle. He claimed that all the United Nations does is write strongly worded letters and speak in empty words. It's sad I had to do these things instead of the United Nations doing them, he said. Still, the reaction to Mr. Trump's bashing of the UN and other countries was muted. Long gone were the days when he was openly laughed at in the chamber. His speech was greeted with polite applause. Afterward, world leaders clamored to meet with him one-on-one, a format in which the American president is known to be less bellicose and more accommodating. In addition to meeting with Mr. Zelensky, Mr. Trump also met with President Javier Milei of Argentina and Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission. He then attended a joint meeting with the leaders of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, Turkey, Pakistan, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan. The meeting with the leaders of predominantly Arab or Muslim countries came at a pivotal time for the war in Gaza, as Israel's military pushes into Gaza City and the country faces allegations in a UN inquiry of carrying out a genocide. And it came with the stark absence of Palestinian leaders, as the Trump administration has denied visas to Mohammed Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, and his delegation. Arab countries have created their own proposal to rebuild Gaza and turn it into part of a future Palestinian state without Hamas in government. Some of the United States' longest-standing allies, including Australia, Britain, and Canada, now recognize Palestine as a state. Mr. Trump has argued that such a designation rewards Hamas and harms efforts to reach a peace agreement with Israel, and he has cast doubt on any eventual two-state solution. Mr. Trump has also insisted that he wants humanitarian aid to flow into Gaza and lamented the real starvation there. But the president has not publicly sought to stop the military push by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel or challenge him to restore pathways for aid. During his speech, Mr. Trump bashed the U.S. allies who were recognizing a Palestinian state. He said those countries should instead unite around a message to Hamas: release the hostages now. Autism doesn't need a cure. Trump's message rankles people living with a disability. Some welcomed more research and possible new treatments, but the administration's embrace of unproven science and depiction of autism as a crisis has sown deep mistrust. Sitting on the couch a few weeks ago watching television, Jonathan Gardner saw something that made him text his mother immediately. Weird question, he typed. Did you take Tylenol at all when you were pregnant with me? He had seen a news report about a scientific review finding a possible correlation, though not a causal link, between the use of acetaminophen during pregnancy and a higher incidence of neurodevelopmental disorders. Mr. Gardner, a 22-year-old local disability advocate in East Bridgewater, Massachusetts, was diagnosed with autism before he turned two. His mother, Nancy Gardner, replied that she didn't take acetaminophen, the active ingredient in the painkiller Tylenol, during pregnancy, and now she worried that a focus on the decisions of mothers would create unnecessary guilt for parents. It's no one's fault when a child has autism, she said in an interview. That's something that many people with autism and their families were repeating on Monday as President Trump and his health secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., launched a broad offensive against the mainstreaming understanding of the condition, including telling pregnant women to resist using Tylenol despite conflicting evidence and a lack of proof it causes autism. "Don't take it," Mr. Trump said in a White House briefing, where he also delivered flawed medical remarks about vaccines and other science on autism, including urging women to tough it out when in pain rather than using acetaminophen. "Fight like hell not to take it," he said. The administration pledged to invest $50 million to study the causes of autism with Mr. Trump and Mr. Kennedy, both pointing toward a possible connection with childhood vaccines. No link has been found despite decades of study, and mainstream scientists overwhelmingly agree that autism is a result of a complex mix of genetic and environmental factors that can't be attributed to a single cause. Likewise, medical groups on Monday quickly rebutted the president's warnings about Tylenol, defending acetaminophen as a safe treatment for fever in pregnant women, although it is not recommended for long-term use. Karen Casso, age 47, of Boise, Idaho, is a mother of two children with autism. She took Tylenol during both of her pregnancies to mitigate the pain from Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a connective tissue disorder. She said urging pregnant women to avoid the painkiller when no link to autism has been proven could be harmful. "Having a fever while you're pregnant can be dangerous," she said. "Having pain while you're pregnant can be dangerous." Kiara Coleman, whose 12-year-old son Keenan has autism, said she did not take Tylenol when she was pregnant, but thinks it's important for mothers to know about the potential risks that could come with medication during their pregnancy. "I just feel that doctors in general need to let parents know, hey, I know you're in pain, but I wish I could give you something that's not going to hurt you or the baby," she said. The Food and Drug Administration was far more circumspect than the remarks made on Monday by Mr. Trump and other top health officials, issuing a letter to doctors that noted accurately that a causal relationship has not been established between acetaminophen and autism. It stated that the matter is an ongoing area of scientific debate. Several people with autism said in interviews that while they support more funding for autism research, they have trouble trusting the Trump administration and are worried about its messages that contradict health experts. "This administration seems to care a lot about autism as a supposed epidemic," said Colin Killick, the executive director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. "It does not seem to care much at all about autistic people. The messages about Tylenol can be especially confusing." Emily Sokolowski, who most recently worked with the Autism Society of America, saw it firsthand this week with her brother Adam, age 32, who has autism, tested positive for COVID-19. On Monday morning, when their mother suggested he take Tylenol to ease his symptoms, he was reluctant because of what he had seen online. "I can't take Tylenol," he told her, according to his sister. "It's going to make my autism worse." Mr. Gardner, the man who texted his mother to ask about her Tylenol use, said it made him nervous that officials seemed to be looking for something to blame without data and proof. He added that some comments from administration officials, including Mr. Kennedy, who said in April that autism destroys families, have led to increased stigma toward people with autism, which Mr. Trump on Monday called a horrible, horrible crisis. "There is definitely much more fear about autism," Mr. Gardner said, adding that the administration was treating it like a terrible disease instead of an intellectual disability. Jordan Zimmerman, age 30, an autistic woman who communicates through augmented methods instead of speaking, said she would rather see the administration focus on expanding such technology, which she did not have access to until she was 18 years old, and providing other support for people with disabilities. "When the administration focuses on things like this," Ms. Zimmerman said in an email interview, "it draws attention away from the things we actually need." Lizzie Graham, age 36, agreed. "Autism doesn't need a cure," said Ms. Graham, a social worker supporting children with autism in Maryland. She was diagnosed when she was in middle school. But Russell Lehman, age 34, who works as a disability advocate at the University of California, Los Angeles, said he would appreciate a treatment to reduce some of the behaviors that he exhibits, such as sensory overload or the need for a rigid routine. Mr. Lehman said he had to drop out of his middle school because he did not receive the support he needed for his autism. an experience he described as isolating. But while he appreciates more money for research, he was dismayed by the way that Mr. Trump and Mr. Kennedy talk about autism. Personally and professionally, he said, it's very disheartening. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump's pick to replace ousted U.S. attorney lacks prosecutorial experience. Lindsay Halligan worked as a personal lawyer for President Trump and then led the effort to scrutinize the Smithsonian for improper ideology. Lindsay Halligan, the lawyer chosen by President Trump to replace the ousted U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia, has left no doubt about her willingness to lead a charge on his behalf. As one of his personal lawyers, Ms. Halligan, a go-for-the-jugular loyalist who is comfortable on television, denounced the FBI when agents seized a classified documents in 2022 from Mar-a-Lago, Mr. Trump's private club and residence in Florida. As a White House special assistant, she has taken the lead in scrutinizing exhibits at the Smithsonian Institute for Improper Ideology. Lacking from her background altogether, however, is any experience in working as a prosecutor or overseeing the complex national security cases that regularly pass through the Eastern District of Virginia. Court records show that Ms. Halligan, who has largely spent her career handling insurance matters in Florida, has filed appearances in only a handful of federal cases during her decade in the law, all of them as one of Mr. Trump's personal lawyers. Despite her slender resume, Mr. Trump declared on Saturday that he planned to nominate Ms. Halligan, age 36, to assume control of one of the country's most important prosecutor's offices at a moment of outsized disarray and tension just after her predecessor, Eric S. Siebert, was forced out by the White House after failing to bring charges against two of the president's perceived enemies. The expectation, as expressed by Mr. Trump in a social media post announcing her appointment, is that Ms. Halligan would get things moving in an office that has been investigating Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, and James P. Comey, the former FBI director. In his post, Mr. Trump called Ms. Halligan a tough prosecutor, and he wasted no time putting her in place. Instead of waiting for a formal nomination and Senate confirmation, Ms. Halligan was hastily sworn in as interim U.S. attorney on Monday. In an indication of how quickly the White House rushed to put her into place, the email sent late Monday afternoon to staff members in the Eastern District about what information to use for official filings initially misspelled her first name. Mr. Trump has not been shy since returning to the White House about stocking the Justice Department with lawyers who have stood up for him. Attorney General Pam Bondi herself helped defend him during his first impeachment trial. Her chief deputy, Todd Blanche, represented him in several of the criminal cases he faced while out of office. But Ms. Bondi and Mr. Blanche had served as prosecutors before ascending to their posts atop the Justice Department. Court records show that Ms. Halligan has never prosecuted any cases and has taken part in only three civil matters in federal court: a failed defamation lawsuit Mr. Trump filed against CNN, an attempt to defend him against a 14th Amendment ballot challenge that was eventually dismissed, and an effort to have the Justice Department freeze its classified documents investigation into Mr. Trump after it conducted a search of Mar-a-Lago. That last maneuver was ultimately ended by scathing ruling from a federal appeals court. The appeals court took particular offense to claims by Ms. Halligan and her partners in the case that Mr. Trump deserves special protection against the search because at the time he was a former president. To create a special exception here would defy our nation's foundational principle that our law applies to all without regard to numbers, wealth, or rank, the appellate judges wrote. Ms. Halligan was an equally robust advocate for Mr. Trump in public and drew on the fact that she was present at Mar-a-Lago when the FBI agents descended on the estate in August 2022 and hauled off reams of classified materials. They looked at God knows what in there and did God knows what in there, Ms. Halligan told Sean Hannity on Fox News shortly after the search. We have no idea. What the FBI did was an appalling display of abuse of power. Tim Parlator, a lawyer who worked with her on the documents case, said he found her to be very hardworking, intelligent, and also with a deep understanding not only of what was going on in the case, but what the president's priorities were. The White House also defended Ms. Halligan. Lindsey Halligan is exceptionally qualified to serve as United States Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, said Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman. She has a proven track record of success and will serve the country with honor and distinction. Ms. Halligan first met Mr. Trump in November 2021 at an event at the Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach, Florida. She told the Washington Post in an interview in April, having come from court, she was wearing a suit. Unlike other guests, she said, when Mr. Trump took note of her and asked her what she did for a living. Less than 1 year later, he brought her on to his legal team. At that point, she had been working as a lawyer for less than a decade, having graduated with a law degree from the University of Miami. She briefly interned for the Innocence Project, which specializes in fighting wrongful convictions, and for the Miami-Dade County Public Defender's Office. But she mostly worked for an insurance firm, Cole, Scott, and Kissane, in Fort Lauderdale, becoming a partner in 2018. When Mr. Trump was reelected, Ms. Halligan followed him from Florida to Washington, taking a job in the White House as a special assistant and senior associate staff secretary. One of her first assignments was to cleanse the Smithsonian Institution of any exhibits or programs that degrade shared American values, divide Americans based on race, or include improper partisan ideology, according to an executive order Mr. Trump issued in March. The order mentioned Ms. Halligan by name, saying she would work closely on the effort with Vice President J.D. Vance. I would say that improper ideology would be weaponizing history, Ms. Halligan told the Post. We don't need to overemphasize the negative to teach people that certain aspects of our nation's history must have been bad. Despite Trump's pressure on Justice Department, certain safeguards are beyond his reach. The criminal justice system has protections that could ultimately give pause to some of President Trump's moves for revenge. In the past few days, President Trump has bulldozed the already faltering tradition of Justice Department independence from the White House. First, he ousted a U.S. attorney who failed to file charges against his political enemies. Then he followed up that extraordinary move with two others, demanding in public that his attorney general go after his adversaries and replacing the career prosecutor who did not meet his demands with an inexperienced loyalist. While the president has openly pressured the Justice Department into charging those he sees as his foes, the criminal justice system he is seeking to control has a few guardrails that lie beyond his reach and could ultimately stop or delay him. Mr. Trump might want to snap his fingers and see opponents like Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, and James B. Comey, the former FBI director, quickly charged, convicted, and put behind bars, but that is not the way the system works. Federal criminal prosecutions require robust procedural safeguards, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote last summer in her stinging dissent to a Supreme Court ruling granting Mr. Trump broad immunity from criminal charges. Bare allegations of malice would not make it out of the starting gate, Justice Sotomayor went on. Although a private civil action may be brought based on little more than intense feelings, a federal criminal prosecution is made of firmer stuff. Here's a look at some of that stuff, the safeguards in the system that could give pause to Mr. Trump's moves for revenge. Prosecutorial norms. Federal prosecutors are bound by Justice Department policy to pursue impartial prosecutions, founded not on whims or partisan politics, but only on the facts and the law. Their discretion and probity is meant to be the first line of defense against purely vengeful charges being filed, They are supposed to bring indictments only if they serve the interests of justice, and they believe they can obtain a conviction and sustain it on appeal. Such norms, of course, while rooted in tradition, do not carry the force of law and can be broken outright or altered over time. Eric S. Siebert was ousted from his post last week atop the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia after failing to indict Ms. James and Mr. Comey. It remains unclear what sort of prosecutor Mr. Siebert's successor, Lindsay Halligan, who worked as Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, will be. Still, U.S. attorneys and their subordinates can stick to principles, even if the only way to do so is to quit their jobs. If they are asked to do something improper or illegal, that, in fact, has happened several times during Mr. Trump's second term in office. In February, Danielle R. Sassoon resigned as the interim U.S. attorney in Manhattan rather than obey an order from a top Justice Department official to drop the corruption case against New York City's mayor, Eric Adams. And in May, Ben Schrader, a top prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Nashville, left his job, court papers say, rather than bring a vindictive prosecution against Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia, the immigrant who was wrongfully deported to El Salvador in March and returned to U.S. soil to face indictment. Grand juries, prosecutors cannot simply will indictments into being. To charge someone with a felony, they have to persuade a grand jury composed of ordinary citizens that there is at least some evidence that a crime was committed. While the evidentiary threshold is low, grand juries still serve as a check on prosecutorial power. An old saying holds that prosecutors are in such complete control of grand jurors that they could get them to indict a ham sandwich if they wanted, but recent events in Washington and Los Angeles have proved that this isn't always true. In the past 2 months, grand jurors in federal district court in Washington have repeatedly refused to indict fellow residents who became entangled in either Mr. Trump's immigration crackdown or in his efforts to flood the city streets with federal troops and agents. The rejections occurred in at least 8 cases, including 3 separate times for the same defendant. Something similar took place in Los Angeles this summer as grand jurors declined to approve indictments against several people arrested during protests against local immigration raids. Many of the defendants had, like those in Washington, been accused of assaulting the authorities. Taken together, the pushback from grand jurors looked a lot like bicoastal revolt against prosecutors seeking to file harsh charges against local residents in an atmosphere of anger or distress over Mr. Trump's political agenda. It remains unclear whether grand jurors in Virginia might do the same if they have to consider felony charges against Ms. James or Mr. Comey. Grand jurors in Maryland could also face an analogous situation if prosecutors seek to obtain an indictment in another case that Mr. Trump has pushed against Senator Adam B. Schiff, Democrat of California. Judicial review. In any of these cases do reach indictment, defense lawyers would move quickly to challenge the charges with motions to dismiss in what would amount to a third line of defense against the prosecution. At this stage, Mr. Trump's own words would come back to haunt him. On social media over the weekend, Mr. Trump preemptively declared that Ms. James, Mr. Comey, and Mr. Schiff were all guilty as hell, but nothing is going to be done. An unfounded statement like that could easily be featured in a motion accusing the Justice Department of taking part in an improperly vindictive prosecution. Such motions are notoriously difficult to win, and yet the defense has recently filed them in a handful of high-profile cases in which the president and his top aides have made public statements suggesting a political animus against the defendant. In Mr. Abrego Garcia's case, lawyers accused the government of bringing charges against him only after he fought his initial deportation. They also said administration officials had made incessant attacks against their client, calling him a gangbanger, monster, illegal predator, illegal alien terrorist, and human trafficker. Mr. Siebert's ouster in Virginia could also wind up being used in an effort to discredit a potential prosecution. Defense lawyers could make hay out of the fact that a man who once ran the prosecutor's office clearly had qualms about bringing charges. Costs of an offensive, nonetheless. While all of these guardrails offer some measure of protection against wrongful or malicious prosecution, sometimes, as criminal justice experts say, the process is the punishment. Even if a prosecution is dismissed or does not pan out, facing criminal charges, especially from a powerful federal government, can be extremely stressful, painfully expensive, and deeply damaging to personal reputation. One of Mr. Trump's close allies, Ed Martin, who runs a so-called weaponization working group, which was created to go after the president's opponents, admitted earlier this year that he plans to use his authority to expose and discredit those he believes to be guilty, even if he cannot find sufficient evidence to prosecute. "If they can be charged, we'll charge them," Mr. Martin told reporters in May. "But if they can't be charged, we will name them, and we will name them, and in a culture that respects shame, they should be people that are ashamed." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. FDA's approval of a drug for autism upends review process. The agency expanded use of an old drug as a treatment for some people with autism. The endorsement sent some customers scrambling to buy over-the-counter supplements with the same ingredients. In taking the unusual step of approving an old generic drug as a treatment for autism, the Food and Drug Administration stunned some experts by departing sharply from the agency's typical standard for reviewing drugs. The drug, leucovorin, has long been used to treat the toxic effects of chemotherapy, but it was endorsed as a therapy for some people with autism by President Trump and top U.S. health officials during a White House briefing on Monday. The move flipped the standard process. Typically, a pharmaceutical company carefully studies a drug, often with input from the FDA on the design of rigorous studies, and then files a formal application for approval. But in this case, the agency said it reviewed medical research and made the approval decision to expand the drug's use on its own. "Mr. President, you told us to do what's medically right, to go bold and not worry about the corporations and the lobbyists," Dr. Marty Makary, the FDA commissioner, said on Monday, "so that's what we're here doing today." Dr. Makary announced the sudden change during the president's briefing on autism, which Mr. Trump repeatedly used to directly link Tylenol, the brand name version of acetaminophen, to the disorder, a connection that is still unproven. The FDA was more cautious in a letter to doctors, saying evidence suggested a link between Tylenol and autism, though the agency added that the association remained an area of scientific debate. The health officials promised to fund more studies to explore a potential connection. Ken View, the maker of Tylenol, has said the drug does not cause autism and is safe to use as directed. While the White House announcement concerned only the prescription drug leucovorin, there were early signs that the federal government's endorsement had already spurred a run on over-the-counter supplements containing the active ingredient in the drug, folinic acid, which is a modified version of vitamin B9, also known as folate. A prominent online supplement seller, iHerb, said that it had sold out of its house brand of folinic acid on Tuesday. The company's website said the product would not be back in stock until late November. The announcement put a spotlight on the company for its now severed ties with Dr. Mehmet Oz, the celebrity doctor who heads the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Dr. Oz, who joined Mr. Trump and Dr. Makary for the announcement on Monday, previously acted as a pitchman for iHerb and had holdings in the company that were valued at an unspecified figure in the range of $5 million to $25 million, according to his disclosure forms. In a disclosure form signed in June by Dr. Oz, he reported that he had sold his stock in iHerb. He also resigned from positions with the company earlier this spring, a spokesman for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said. The health department said in a post on X that Mr. Trump and health officials had discussed only leucovorin on Monday and that the drug was not to be conflated with any over-the-counter drugs or supplements. At the briefing on Monday, Dr. Makary promoted the prescription drug as likely to help hundreds of thousands of children with autism, yet the agency's notice in the Federal Register indicated a narrower application. The FDA approved tablets of leucovorin specifically to treat cerebral folate deficiency, a condition characterized by low levels of folate, a vitamin V, a B vitamin in spinal fluid that is associated with delays in a child's development and poor motor skills. Dr. McCary said in an interview with ABC News that about 20 to 50% of children with autism had the deficiency. Some outside experts said that the agency's decision on lorcoverin, which is believed to improve speech and cognitive abilities in people with autism, left many questions unanswered. Dr. Aaron Kesselheim, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, called the FDA's hasty endorsement of lorcoverin shocking. Before prescribing the tablets, doctors would first need to determine whether a patient suffered from the deficiency, Dr. Kesselheim said. How they would arrive at that diagnosis, short of a risky, expensive spinal tap, was not clear, he said. A spokesman from the Health and Human Services Department said the diagnosis can be made with a genetic test, blood test, or by giving the drug and seeing if there is a benefit. The FDA's action also failed to clarify the appropriate dose of lorcoverin for children and adults, which is typically determined by each drug maker from clinical studies. Dr. Kesselheim also noted that the study cited by the FDA showed only small improvements in autism symptoms among people with certain folate levels in their spinal fluid. This puts the cart about 3 miles in front of the horse, Dr. Kesselman said. The reason we have FDA is to try to help patients distinguish between things that do and don't work. Holly Fernandez Lynch, an associate professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, said the agency's recommendations seem like a science communication disaster. Few people would be likely to realize that a treatment touted as a salve for autism only applied to a subset of patients, she said, adding that the vagueness of the announcement seemed intentional. Like we solved it, she said. That's exactly what this administration wanted. The approval itself, including a description of a small study, also falls far below the agency's standard for reviewing a treatment for a condition as common as autism, she said. Small studies are not unheard of, but are typically done in the case of an extremely rare disease that is difficult to examine. I think this is a dangerous kind of subversion of what FDA approval is supposed to be, she said. An HHS spokesman said the approval took into account the rarity and severity of the condition as well as the apparent clinical benefits. The FDA asked GSK, the original company that applied for approval of lorcoverin, to update the label on the product, which the company sold during the 1980s and the 1990s. It is a procedural step that will enable several companies that make generic versions to adopt the label's language. GSK said in a statement that it no longer sells the drug, but will update the label. Daniel Aaron, an associate professor of law at the University of Utah who studies the FDA, said the agency's decision on lorcoverin could set a precedent for other companies that want to skip costly, careful, and years-long clinical trials before asking the agency for an approval. This approval could very much well come to haunt the FDA, he said. Some customers on Tuesday appeared not to be waiting for a prescription. Folinic acid supplements, which deliver a lower dose of the ingredient than lorcoverin, can be purchased online without a prescription, creating a more convenient and also more lightly regulated avenue for parents to buy the product. Supplement companies make and sell other forms of folate too, which is naturally found in beans, leafy greens, eggs, beets, and citrus. Those include folic acid, which for decades has also been added to certain foods to reduce the risk of babies being born with neural tube defects. Some supplement companies seized on the newfound attention to folate to promote their own products. In a marketing email on Tuesday morning, the wellness company, a Florida supplement seller that has ties to prominent supporters of Mr. Trump's, advertised a vitamin B product that contains folate. No, we're not claiming it is going to cure or prevent autism, the email said. We simply believe that good nutrition and wise supplementation are keys to a healthier lifestyle. And iHerb, the online supplement seller, sold out of its own California Gold Nutrition brand of folinic acid, though the company said that purchases of the product had already been trending higher because of a September sale. Parents of autistic children have turned to folinic acid supplements as a way of overcoming difficulties accessing the drug in the past, said Edward V. Quadros, a research professor at SUNY Downstate Health Sciences University, who has studied the relationship between folate and autism. He said he was reluctant to suggest online folinic acid supplements himself because the manufacturing of those products is not as stringently regulated as the manufacturing of drugs. Supplement industry trade groups said that their member companies were careful to abide by rules restricting them from saying that their products cure, mitigate, or treat disease. But they noted that not everyone has access to a doctor who can prescribe the drug form of folinic acid, and they cheered the administration's emphasis on the health benefits of folate. Folate's important, and anything that reiterates the importance of folate is, I think, critical to American health, said Daniel Fabricant, the president and chief executive of the Natural Products Association, a leading trade association for the dietary supplement industry. At the same time, we have restrictions on what we can and can't say, and we're going to abide by those. Jimmy Kimmel, somber but defiant, defends free speech in return to ABC. The late-night star said he had not intended to make light of Charlie Kirk's murder, but he also said that President Trump's threat against ABC was anti-American. Jimmy Kimmel broke his silence on Tuesday night in an emotional return to ABC's airwaves. By turns defiant, joking, and somber as he addressed the controversy that temporarily sidelined his late-night show and set off a national debate over free speech. His voice breaking at times, Mr. Kimmel said he understood why his comments last week about the suspected shooter of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk seemed ill-timed or unclear, or maybe both, he added. It was never my intention to make light of the murder of a young man. But Mr. Kimmel also had harsh words for President Trump and the government regulator, who suggested that the Trump administration would punish ABC because of his remarks, saying that a government threat to silence a comedian the president doesn't like is anti-American. This show is not important, Mr. Kimmel said in his opening monologue. What's important is that we get to live in a country that allows us to have a show like this. Executives at Disney, ABC's parent company, pulled Jimmy Kimmel live off the air last week shortly after the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Brendan Carr, suggested that his agency could take action against the network. On Tuesday, Mr. Kimmel said he disagreed with Disney's decision to pull his show, but he also credited the company where he has worked for 22 years for defending his right to poke fun at the powerful. Unfortunately, and I think unjustly, this puts them at risk, Mr. Kimmel said. The President of the United States made it very clear he wants to see me and the hundreds of people who work here fired from our jobs. Our leader celebrates Americans losing their livelihoods because he can't take a joke. During his monologue, which was frequently interrupted by a cheering crowd, Mr. Kimmel thanked several Republican officials, including Senators Ted Cruz, Mitch McConnell, and Rand Paul, who had expressed misgivings about the FCC pressuring ABC. I want to thank the people who don't support my show and what I believe, but support my right to share those beliefs anyway, he said. Tearing up, he also praised Erica Kirk, Mr. Kirk's widow, who at a public memorial on Sunday said that she forgave the person accused of murdering her husband. It touched me deeply, Mr. Kimmel said in his voice hoarse. If there's anything we should take from this tragedy to carry forward, I hope it can be that and not this. Later, in a surprise cameo, the actor Robert De Niro appeared as a mob boss who has taken over the FCC. Mr. De Niro starred in Goodfellas, the mafia film that Mr. Cruz invoked last week in criticizing Mr. Carr's remarks. Mr. Kimmel's return to the airwaves on Tuesday was one of the most anticipated episodes of late-night television in years. Even President Trump weighed in before it began. I can't believe ABC fake news gave Jimmy Kimmel his job back, he complained in a social media post roughly an hour before Mr. Kimmel's show was set to air. Mr. Trump suggested that he might sue ABC over its reinstatement of Mr. Kimmel. I think we're going to test ABC out on this, he wrote, and cited a $16 million payment that the network made last year to settle a previous defamation lawsuit that he filed against ABC News. Not everyone in the country was able to watch the return of Jimmy Kimmel live. Two large station groups, Nexstar and Sinclair, preempted the episode from the ABC affiliates they own and said they will continue to do so going forward. Those two station groups represent a little more than 20% of ABC's national reach combined. At one of those stations in Nashville, a local anchor announced a one-hour news special during Mr. Kimmel's usual time slot. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll explore all the people and places that make this community unique, the anchor said. Disney owns and operates the local affiliates in some of the country's largest markets, including in the New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago metropolitan areas, all of which did air the episode. Other local television owners, including Hearst and Gray Media, also air Jimmy Kimmel Live as normal. Mr. Kimmel's abrupt and unlikely role as a champion for the First Amendment was apparent outside the host's Hollywood Boulevard studio on Tuesday, in the hours before his taping began. About a dozen supporters gathered with placards, including a man in head-to-toe patriotic garb, brandishing a large sign that read, "Liberty." "Today, free speech won," said Greg Donovan, age 65, of Santa Monica, California, who held a sign reading, "Welcome back, Jimmy." "I'm happy for Jimmy," he said, adding, "Hollywood missed him." The longtime ABC star was sidelined on September 17th, just hours after Mr. Carr criticized Mr. Kimmel. "We can do this the easy way or the hard way," Mr. Carr said, in suggesting the FCC could take action against ABC and Disney. Mr. Kimmel had originally planned to address the imbroglio in his opening monologue on September 17th, but Disney's leadership decided to pull his show indefinitely instead. Robert A. Iger, Disney's chief executive, and Dana Walden, the company's head of television, were concerned that if his planned remarks aired that night, he would risk inflaming the situation even further. The suspension of Jimmy Kimmel Live quickly turned into a flashpoint about free speech in America. Liberals and even some conservatives said that the pressure Mr. Carr applied to ABC represented a chilling suppression of the First Amendment. Mr. Carr tried to minimize his role this week, saying that Disney had made a business decision and that accusations of suppression of free speech were part of a campaign of projection and distortion. On September 15th, Mr. Kimmel used his opening monologue to say that the MAGA gang was desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it. It took about a day for his comments to gain steam on social media, but once they did, conservatives pounced. They said Mr. Kimmel had mischaracterized the political beliefs of Tyler Robinson, the accused shooter. Mr. Carr said that his comments were part of a concerted effort to lie to the American people. Prosecutors have said that Mr. Robinson objected to Mr. Kirk's hatred, but the authorities have not said which of Mr. Kirk's views Mr. Robinson had found hateful. Mr. Robinson's mother said that her son had recently shifted to the political left. Mr. Kimmel's show usually draws a nightly audience of 1.6 million viewers, according to Nielsen. Television executives are anticipating that its viewership, even without a few dozen local stations, will be significantly higher on Tuesday. Kathy Hopkins, who was a member of the audience, said that the atmosphere inside the studio had been emotional, and that Mr. Kimmel at times fought back tears, but that he also stood his ground. "He didn't bend the knee and become subservient and say, 'Okay, I'm a shadow of Jimmy now,'" Ms. Hopkins said. "There were lots of love and lots of gravity in there. We were all just thrilled to have him back." You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. America is not a safe place to work. Koreans describe Georgia raid. Some of the workers arrested this month at a Hyundai LG factory said although they had entered the United States under murky circumstances, they had always planned to return home. They thought they were the kind of highly skilled engineers who could help fulfill President Trump's goal of reviving American manufacturing. Park Sun-kye said he had built factories that make electric car batteries in Indonesia, Michigan, and Ohio. Kim Min-soo said that he had built or worked in such facilities in Poland, Ohio, and Tennessee. Net Cho, an HVAC guru, said he had helped put up a nuclear power plant in the United Arab Emirates and a Samsung semiconductor factory in Texas. All three are South Korean citizens, and all of them had gone back to the United States this year. Along with hundreds of their compatriots, they were working in a sprawling 2,900-acre complex built by the South Korean company Hyundai in southeastern Georgia to make electric cars. They were finishing up a battery factory at the site, which the state's governor had praised for bringing thousands of new jobs for Georgians. On the morning of September 4th, Mr. Park said he was in an office teaching a colleague how to troubleshoot a computerized manufacturing system when a U.S. agent carrying a handgun barged in and shouted, "Everyone outside." Mr. Kim said he was supervising in a dry room where the temperature and moisture were kept at precise levels for machines to produce sample batteries. A commotion broke out in the room as a security manager called to report a raid by armed officers. Outside, the agents moved swiftly, spreading out through the premises. Mr. Cho said he was checking his team's balance sheets in his office when he saw helicopters and armored vehicles outside. They were soon swept up in what U.S. officials called the largest ever Homeland Security enforcement operation at a single location. The walkers were held in shackles. They were detained for a week in what they described as poor conditions and accused the U.S. authorities of rights abuses. The raid was a head-on collision of Mr. Trump's immigration and trade policies, and it has deeply unsettled South Korea, a key U.S. ally. Its diplomats haggled with Washington for a week until the country was able to fly the workers home. Days after the repatriation, six returnees interviewed by the New York Times said they were still struggling to process what had happened to them. Mr. Park said he is seeing a doctor because he is having trouble sleeping. My main takeaway is that America is not a safe place to work, Mr. Park said. I don't think I would go there again to work. A U.S. disconnect. The United States and South Korea have deep ties rooted in decades-long military alliance that made the raid all the more shocking to many Koreans. The returnees said their predicament was the outcome of a mismatch of American desires and actions. For decades, South Korean companies such as Hyundai have built and operated factories in the United States. Recently, Washington has persuaded South Korea to commit hundreds of billions of dollars to build new factories using the threat to increase tariffs on South Korean exports as leverage. But there are not enough skilled workers in the United States to construct the factories at wages that are economically viable for the companies, industry insiders contend, nor has Washington issued enough work visas for foreigners to do the job. Last week, Mr. Trump added another hurdle by imposing huge fees on the new H-1B visa applicants. To address that mismatch, many South Korean companies, like the ones hired by Hyundai and LG to build the battery factory, rotate workers in and out of construction sites. They enter the United States on short-term business or tourist visas, sometimes skirting the law. U.S. and South Korean authorities have not disclosed the visa details for the 317 Koreans who were arrested on September 4th, but five of the six engineers the Times interviewed were on six-month B-1 visas, which allow consulting with business associates. One traveled on the 90-day visa waiver program called the Electronic System for Travel Authorization, or ESTA, which allows travel for business or pleasure. They all said they were on business trips since they were being paid by their employers back in South Korea. We knew that we were treading a gray zone between legal and illegal, said Mr. Park, who avoided physical work involving tools to meet the terms of his B-1 visa. Our plan was to finish our trip in 2 to 3 months and return home and make another trip to the U.S. after an interval of 2 to 3 months. The raid, more than 400 U.S. agents descended on the Ellabelle complex that Thursday. They first sifted out U.S. citizens. From the non-citizens, they screened out people on ESTA, B-1 and B-2, a visa for tourists, ordering them to fill out worksheets that asked for personal information and questions such as whether they entered the United States legally. The form was only in English and Spanish, and workers said the officers did not bring any Korean translators, so English-speaking workers volunteered. At least one person was forced to leave the country even though he was there legally, the Times reported earlier this month. Mr. Kim, age 34, said he didn't worry at first, even when he and his colleagues were ordered to put their belongings in mesh bags. One agent even told him, "I will let you go home," Mr. Kim said. The mood shifted when people on ESTA and B-1 and B-2 visas were served arrest warrants, hauled into buses in handcuffs and chains, and taken to an Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention facility in Folkston, Georgia. The Korean workers said they are still wondering why they were arrested on the basis of their visas and were not told what laws they were violating. They wondered why they, who were creating jobs for the local community, were being held. "We were not there to settle down as permanent workers," said Mr. Cho, age 55. Mr. Kim said the goal of subcontractors like him was to complete their task and leave as fast as possible. "If you miss the target date, it means more cost for you because you are not paid for the extra months you work," he said. Accusations of abuse. In the detention center, workers said they were divided into five pods, each holding as many as 80 people. For meals, they were given an apple and ham and cheese sandwiches or meat gruel with rice or baked beans. They drank from water fountains or containers. Along one wall, there were shower stalls, urinals, and toilets. Only a low wall and a low curtain separated those who were using the toilets from the common area. Since their repatriation, a few dozen workers have started a chat group where they discuss their claims of human rights abuses. They said that the authorities never read them their rights or explained what they were being arrested. With their cell phones confiscated, they could not call their families, employers, or lawyers. When they were allowed to use phones at the detention center, they could not make international calls. They have reportedly smelly drinking water, moldy mattresses, dusty blankets, freezing air conditioning, and officials' tardy response to requests for medical aid. One worker in the chat accused guards of pulling their eyes sideways in a racist gesture against Asians. The racial discrimination and sneering at how the United States viewed us will linger long in my heart, the worker wrote. South Korea's foreign ministry has said it will investigate allegations of human rights abuse. The U.S. Embassy in Seoul did not respond to a request for comment. The workers said that the U.S. officials who interviewed them individually at the detention center gave them a choice: agree to voluntarily leave the United States because they violated their terms of admission, or stay and fight their cases in court. Mr. Kim said an American officer warned him that legal proceedings could take months. The South Korean government counseled the same. Eventually, all but one of the Koreans agreed to voluntarily depart. Until the last minute, one detail remained unresolved. U.S. officials wanted the workers to be handcuffed for their four-hour bus ride to Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport for their trip home. South Korean officials objected, but the workers had grown so sick of the detention center that some protested to visiting South Korean diplomats that they wanted to go home as soon as possible, whether in handcuffs or not. The South Korean government eventually prevailed, and the workers were not handcuffed. It also said that Washington promised not to disadvantage the workers if they tried to re-enter the United States after the visa dispute was sorted out. Not all want to, but Mr. Cho said he would have gone back to the factory site straight from the detention center had he been allowed to. "My pride is not as important as finishing the work I have started," he said. The battery factory has been expected to be ready by the end of the year and create 400 new jobs. It is now delayed by at least a few months. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 24th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Claudia, and I thank you for listening.